Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ah, yes, Budget Day. Does not get any better than this, now does it? All right, yes, it actually does. The budget, some Bitcoin, and a little bit of central banking on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by 23andMe DNA Kit, designed to provide over 200 personalized health reports and knowledge to make informed personal health decisions. Your DNA Kit is available at 23andMe.com/marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 10th of April, which, if you stop to check the closest calendar, makes the president's budget that the White House released today just a hair over 2 months late. The timing, one might reasonably presume, was intentional. It lets the president split the difference between the democratically controlled Senate's budget and the House GOP plan, both of which dropped last month. And you would think, wouldn't you, there's got to be some common ground, something in all three of them that stands a chance of actually becoming law someday. Marketplace's David Gura gets us going.
Well, they're all in English. That's something. Ross Baker teaches political science at Rutgers. He says, for the most part, the similarities end there.
You kind of put them together side by side, and it's sort of like setting up a dinner party for a vegetarian, a vegan, and somebody who's on the paleo diet and eats nothing but meat.
I spent about 20 minutes at the printer today, printing out copies of the House budget, the Senate budget, and the President's budget. Altogether, they're 478 pages. That's about a ream's worth of paper. And in all that, there's not much overlap. We see some, Baker says, between the president's budget and the Senate's. Keep in mind the Senate, which is controlled by the president's party, passed its budget along party lines.
Both of them call for tax increases on upper-income Americans. The Ryan budget does not have that.
That's the House's budget, drafted by Republican Paul Ryan. It calls for reforms to entitlement programs, including Social Security. There's some of that in the president's plan, but not in the Senate's. Matthew Shapiro teaches economics at Michigan, and he says that even though we have three different budgets, he's cautiously optimistic.
It's a positive step that concrete proposals are on the table.
But will any of these proposals become law? Well, that's anyone's guess. The Obama administration defends its budget tomorrow on Capitol Hill. Here in the D.C. Bureau, we've stacked it on top of the House budget and the Senate budget, and we've got a new doorstop. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
David makes fun, as do I, mostly so we don't cry, I suppose. But the truth is that what's in all those doorstops piling up in our Washington Bureau will somehow eventually affect the actual economy, big companies, individual taxpayers, and small businesses. Steve Presser runs a toy store out in Cleveland, Ohio. Mr. Presser, it's good to have you with us.
Hello, Kai. How are you, sir?
I'm all right, thank you. But let me ask you, as a small business owner in the American economy, how much are you following? How much do you care about the budget process in Washington?
Well, I follow it, and of course I care about it. The big question for me and most of my peers and colleagues is how it will affect us.
Well, how do you imagine it might?
Well, the question is, will it directly affect us? We're all positive about what's going on. We want to see things that are going to, of course, positively affect the small business owner, but we're not sure how far down it will trickle down to us.
So we're talking about things like discretionary income. We're talking about sales tax increases. I mean, what are we talking about?
And keep going. You're yes and yes. All the factors, absolutely. You know, healthcare, all the big buzzwords affect the small business person just like it affects the big one.
You know, much has been made of the fact that Democrats in the Senate have not come up with a budget for 4 years. The president's budget that came out today is 2 months late. The Republicans proposed the same budget basically this year that they did last year. How do you, as a guy who actually has to run a business, how do you do your budget?
Do our budget. You know, it's like anything else. We all have to try to get as creative as we can with budget making. And, you know, there are so many obstacles to budget. My small business, like the government's large business, we have to do cuts. We have to decide what is important, what will move our business forward and ahead in the next days, the next weeks, the next years, and hopefully grow it into the next decade to come.
Do you have any faith that the people who are actually doing all the budget talking in Washington today, whether it's Nancy Pelosi or Mitch McConnell or the President of the United States, do you have any faith that they have you in mind?
Boy, you got me on that one. Do I have faith? I'm a superior optimist. I'm a surrealist. How's that one? I do have faith. Do I believe that they're really listening to the small person on Main Street? I think they're not listening enough.
How is business for you?
It's actually picking up, so I'm smiling right now. Cleveland is in the Rust Belt. We've taken it on the chin for many years, but we're growing tremendously because of the health and educational fields in our community. And I'm starting to see people spend a little bit more money in my store. I said before, I'm an optimistic person. I'm now smiling, so I'm a little bit more optimistic than I was 2 years ago.
Good to hear. Steve Presser, he owns a toy store in Cleveland, Ohio. It's called Big Fun Toy Store. Mr. Presser, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Kai, it's always a pleasure.
On Wall Street today, more record highs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The macroeconomic phrase of the day is chained CPI. President Obama used it in his budget today as a way to cut Social Security payments. The idea, speaking really broadly here, is that when the price of certain goods goes up, consumers typically switch to lower cost substitutes. If the price of, say, steak rises, they switch to hamburger. And so inflation overall, and thus Social Security payments, rise more slowly. Commentator Robert Reich, though, points out that not everything has an easy down market replacement. Take, just for instance, he says, healthcare for seniors.
Under the president's plan, we could save more than $100 billion on Social Security over the next 10 years by using this lower measure of inflation. The problem is the elderly spend a much larger share of their incomes on healthcare than the rest of us. When prices go up on some aspects of healthcare, cheaper substitutes may not be available or as effective. If a doctor prescribes a particular test or procedure, most patients, particularly the elderly, are not going to argue in the first place. In addition, the costs of health care have been rising faster than inflation. Because seniors buy more health care than the rest of us, even Social Security's current inflation adjustment may understate the true impact of inflation on them. Social Security benefits are already meager for most recipients. The median income of Americans over 65 is under $20,000 a year, and most depend on Social Security for more than half of it. The average Social Security benefit is less than $15,000 a year. Besides, Social Security doesn't contribute to the budget deficit, and it's not in serious trouble. Its trust fund is flush for at least two decades. If we want to ensure its solvency beyond that, we don't have to hurt beneficiaries. We could raise the cap on income subject to Social Security taxes, which is now nearly $114,000, or fully tax the payout for wealthy beneficiaries. So why is the president even suggesting the chained CPI for Social Security? Republicans aren't asking for it. Not even Paul Ryan's draconian budget includes it. Democrats invented Social Security and have been protecting it for almost 80 years. They shouldn't be leading the charge against it.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. It's been a noisy couple of weeks on the Korean Peninsula. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has shut down a joint South Korean industrial park. There's talk of another North Korean missile test any day now. Japan has put anti-missile defenses around Tokyo, and it's gotten so bad that even China, now a longtime friend of the North Korean regime, is getting frustrated. Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz has more now on what's at stake for the world's second biggest economy.
China's new president, Xi Jinping, is a busy guy. He's inherited a massive economy with a lot of problems. And now, next door, threats of Armageddon from a man the Chinese have nicknamed Fat Little Kim. Over the weekend at an international conference, President Xi said nobody should be allowed to throw the world into chaos for selfish gains. It was the latest sign that China is growing annoyed by Kim Jong-un's antics.
I sense them coming to a kind of crunch point.
William McCahill, a former U.S. diplomat in Beijing, is managing director of Religare Capital.
I know from my own conversations with Chinese officials that they warned the Koreans in the strongest possible terms not to detonate the third nuclear test, and the Koreans went ahead and did that. The Chinese were just absolutely livid.
A volatile North Korea is a big distraction for Xi Jinping. He's been trying to focus on tough changes at home, reforming China's economy by seizing power from state-run companies.
A move against those is going to require all the political capital that he can muster.
The worst-case scenario for China would be war on the Korean Peninsula. Cai Jian is Korean studies professor at Fudan University.
If there are problems, the result would be a flood of North Korean refugees streaming over the border into China, and that would be bad for China's economy.
North Korea has always been a buffer state between China and South Korea. A toppled regime in Pyongyang would also mean an important American ally with U.S. military support would suddenly be on China's doorstep. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The reason these guys are able to respond quickly and on a scale that's commensurate with the problems that we faced is precisely because they're secretive guys who meet in private in a big building in Basel and in these strange places.
And yet they run the global economy. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials hit a new high today, 128 points on the upside, 0.9%, closed at 14,802. The NASDAQ added 59 points, 1.8%. 32.97 at the bell. The S&P 500 gained 19 points, 1.2% there. Finished at 15.87, also just by the by, a record. Health Management Associates fell 16% today after the hospital operator said revenue is below expectations. It blamed fewer admissions, especially in its Florida hospitals. Tenet Healthcare, another hospital chain, was down 5.5% on an analyst downgrade. Pfizer rose 2.75% today after the FDA designated a breast cancer drug it's working on a breakthrough therapy. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.81%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by 23andMe, a personal DNA kit so individuals can better understand how their genes impact health, which means individuals and their doctors find health areas to keep an eye on. 23andMe also gives ancestry information and helps discover global origins or perhaps find relatives. Available today at 23andMe.com/marketplace. That's the number 23andMe.com/marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. The Senate Finance Committee holds a hearing on the President's fiscal year 2014 budget. And some folks mark International Louie Louie Day because, well, because they love that party song. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. And there is more to Washington policymaking than just budgets, you know. Rumors are rife that there's going to be a deal on immigration reform coming any day now. It'll be chock full of stuff. I've heard it's going to be 1,500 pages long. Enforcement is probably going to be a big part of it. Not just keeping undocumented immigrants out, but making sure companies don't hire ones that might already be here. And for better or for worse, that means use of a program called E-Verify is going to grow. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains what we're talking about.
E-Verify works like this. You get hired for a new job. You give your new boss your ID. The boss feeds your information into E-Verify. It runs you through several government databases to be sure you're authorized to work in the U.S. It's supposed to be painless, but it's not foolproof. Just ask Jessica St. Pierre.
Well, I got fired for something that I've never heard of.
St. Pierre is now extremely well acquainted with E-Verify. But in November of 2010, it was new and mystifying to her. St. Pierre's parents are immigrants from Haiti and the Bahamas. But she was born in Florida, which is why she was confused when the phone company she was working for fired her that fateful November. E-Verify had flagged her as an unauthorized worker. Turns out her employer had made a simple clerical error. St. Pierre puts a period after the Saint part of her last name, but her employer's computer system didn't do that, confusing E-Verify.
What ended up happening was that the employer placed two spaces after the ST. That is what caused all of this.
That punctuation problem left St. Pierre unemployed for almost 3 months. She finally landed a new job, paying $2 less an hour. So why would Congress consider making E-Verify mandatory for every employer if it gets tripped up by an extra space in someone's name?
It's a system that actually has shown improvements over time.
Muzaffar Chishti is with the Migration Policy Institute. He's studied E-Verify since 1997. He says, yes, there have been mistakes. Chishti says, at first, E-Verify's error rate was terrible, 8 to 10%. But now, it's down to less than 2%.
Clearly, there is still error in the system, but it has certainly gone down over the years, and that's progress.
But immigrant rights groups say even the lowest error rate of 0.8% works out to more than a million people being falsely labeled as unauthorized to work. And Chishti says E-Verify still isn't quite ready for prime time. Only 350,000 employers are using it right now. That could spike to 8 million under immigration reform. Still, employers are now assuming that E-Verify will be part of any immigration legislation coming out of Washington. Tamar Jacoby is president of Immigration Works, a federation of labor-intensive businesses like restaurants and farms.
I would bet my house and my car that there is going to be mandatory E-Verify for all U.S. businesses in any immigration reform that comes out of Congress.
Jacoby says E-Verify is continuing to improve, experimenting with a self-serve system that gives workers a password and security questions so they can prove their identity and their eligibility to work. That's cold comfort for Jessica St. Pierre. Jessica laughs a lot, joking with her grandmother in the kitchen of her North Miami home, occasionally lapsing into Creole as they plan a family vacation.
You going?
Yeah, I'm going.
Okay, so we gotta go buy a ticket.
But despite her easy laugh, Jessica is still traumatized by her brush with E-Verify. She's applied for a few jobs with employers who use it.
Oh, man, the stress comes back. What if they run my name through the system again? It's something that, you know, you constantly want to look over your shoulder because I got fired for it. I don't want to get fired for it again.
E-Verify is not up to par, St. Pierre says, and she worries that it never will be. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Just when you thought Facebook couldn't get its nose any deeper into our lives, here it goes again. This time, it's yet another way to serve us up to advertisers. The social network rolled out a new tool today, one that combines what Facebook knows about us, our friends, our likes, all that stuff, with a whole bunch of data collected about us by other firms, and then rolls it all into one big ad targeting machine. Marketplace's Noel King reports.
Facebook already knows a lot about what you like. Now it's going to know even more. The social network is partnering with outside data firms to collect information on how users behave on other websites and offline. Fatima Katablu is a senior analyst with Forrester Research. She says the benefit for Facebook...
They're really enriching what they know about how consumers actually behave transactionally.
Like in the grocery store, where a lot of us use rewards cards. She says, take a company like Red Bull, the energy drink. To find new customers, Red Bull might start with...
people buying Pepsi, so they're buying a caffeinated soda.
And because of their likes on Facebook?
We know that they like things like base jumping.
Those are exactly the people Red Bull wants to target. Facebook is banking on those data combinations to lure advertisers, new ones and old ones, like General Motors. The car company dropped its Facebook ads last year. It didn't think they were working. This week, GM came back. Neiman Marcus is also on board. But privacy experts are concerned that Facebook knows too much. Jeffrey Chester is executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy, a consumer privacy watchdog.
Another way to think about this is kind of 24/7 surveillance when you're in the street, when you're in the store.
Facebook says it's not offering up individual consumers, just big groups. You feel better now? I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
All right, so I get it if your eyes glaze over on those rare occasions we start talking about foreign exchange rates. I mean, unless you're traveling, it's tough to care about the yen-dollar spread, I know. Today, though, something a little bit different, a virtual currency that has honestly been going just bonkers, Bitcoin, it's called. It was invented 4 years ago. Some see it as a safe haven, sort of like gold. Today, though, Bitcoin was anything but safe. The price hit a record high of $268 per Bitcoin and then tumbled more than $100 in just hours, and then shot back up again. Not a pretty picture at all. So Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has a Bitcoin briefing.
A Bitcoin is not an actual coin.
When you hold a Bitcoin, you don't actually really hold any Bitcoins. You hold this private key.
This is Michael Tumim. He started buying Bitcoins in September. That private key is like a password.
That lets you prove to everybody on the internet who's running the Bitcoin software that you own that money is allocated to you.
So in the same way that a dollar is a piece of paper that people have faith in, a Bitcoin is a highly encrypted agreement that people have faith in. It's not regulated by any government, and that's one reason it's taken off. There are 11 million Bitcoins in circulation right now. This morning, I talked to Alex Lysenko. He's in Germany. Last month, he paid 3,000 euros to buy 50 Bitcoins.
How many euros or dollars is it worth right now?
So the 10,000 euros.
Well, that was this morning. Right now, while he's sleeping, his Bitcoins have fallen in value by a third.
I'm not surprised to see the price falling. Bitcoin, by its very nature, is very prone to bubbles.
Simon Barber is with the Palo Alto Research Center.
The fundamental values of Bitcoin is just based on the trust and confidence that people have in it. And as soon as anything happens to shake that, then people start to sell their Bitcoins.
In this case, it's reportedly a series of hack attacks that are clogging up the main site used to buy and sell Bitcoins. Barber says this volatility will fade over time.
Now, in the long term, Bitcoin does have some fundamental value.
He says it's anonymous, unregulated, and almost impossible to counterfeit. So it's not going away. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We got the minutes of the most recent Federal Reserve meeting today. The executive summary goes a little something like this. No big policy changes coming, at least in the short term. You know, the Fed, more than any other institution out there, is actually doing things to work on the economy, mostly because it can. Central bankers have gobs of power without really having to answer to anybody. That power and how it's been used by three men, Ben Bernanke, Mervyn King of the Bank of England, and Jean-Claude Trichet of the European Central Bank, is the subject of a new book. It's called The Alchemists, and it's by Neil Irwin of the Washington Post. Neil, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you know what this book is? It's Andrew Ross Sorkin wrote Too Big to Fail. This is the central bank counterpart to that one, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we had, after the 2008 crisis, a lot of great books were written telling of all these dramatic events that happened on Wall Street and in Washington. In truth, though, the story was just beginning at that point. And what we've had in the last five, 6 years is really a global story that takes place on in the United States, in Europe, in Britain. And over again, it's been the central bankers. It's been these guys at the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank and the Bank of England who have come together and dealt with this sprawling crisis that keeps zooming from continent to continent and from market to market.
If they could have a do-over right now, the three of them, just a mulligan, what do you think they would do?
You know, the biggest mistakes in this last 6 years of global crisis have been the opportunities not taken. There's a consistent reluctance to deal with the small problem early on, and instead it becomes a very big problem.
Yeah, you know, that kind of plays into there's a secondary theme through this book, not just the who's and what's of the crisis, but the role of central banking. And I wonder if part of that hesitation you talk about hesitating to do the really big things early on is because these guys know that the world is watching, that they can fix things maybe, but also screw it up just immensely.
There's a deep-seated culture within the central banks of choosing your words very carefully. Part of that's because markets go haywire if they say things more bluntly. At the same time, in extreme situations, it's the central banks who have the power and the ability and the speed and the bottomless resources to be able to deal with panics when they happen. Fundamentally, central banks are anti-democratic organizations. But in a crisis, in a panic, it's also our least bad option.
Make the value judgment for me then, though. I mean, how are we doing on the this is an essentially undemocratic institution but operates with some speed and efficiency versus these guys are meeting in secret private rooms determining the fate of the world economy?
Well, those are both true. I don't see how you can – I mean, it's very hard to separate one from the other. The reason these guys are able to respond quickly and on a scale that's commensurate with the problems that we faced is precisely because they're secretive guys who meet in private in these strange places. That's what allows them to respond and act on such a large scale.
A lot was made early in the days of the crisis of Ben Bernanke and his academic background. You know, wrote the PhD thesis on the Great Depression, and boy, there could not be anybody more suited to this moment in time. Can you really be ready for this job ever?
No one's ready for this job. It's an even harder job now than it was in 2006 when Ben Bernanke took the job. And frankly, Ben Bernanke in 2006 wouldn't be qualified for the job today. Look, a good central banker has to be a lot of things. He or she has to be an excellent economist, first of all. They have to be a superb manager. They have to run these very large institutions. They have to be a politician. They have to navigate within their country's political system. They have to be a regulator. They have to know how to oversee banks to try and prevent risks to the financial system. They have to be a communicator. They have to do press conferences and go to Capitol Hill and testify before politicians. There are very few people in the world who are good at all of those things. And so what you find if you're a head of state trying to appoint a central banker, you have to find someone who's good enough at all of them and hope that they learn on the job.
Neil Irwin is a columnist at The Washington Post. He's got a new book out. It's called The Alchemists. It's about central banks and central bankers. Neil, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which President Obama chooses between cigarettes, sodas, and booze, David Leonhardt points out on the New York Times website this afternoon that in his budget, the president preferred taxes on tobacco over those on soft drinks and alcohol. The federal tax on a pack of smokes would just about double under the president's plan, almost $2 a pack it would be. Federal taxes on soda and beer, wine, and hard liquor, meanwhile, haven't budged in 20 years or more. Pick your sin, I suppose. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 128 points, 0.9%. The NASDAQ added 59 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 gained 19 points. That is 1.2% on that particular index. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.